The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen, hour two of the National Intel Report. I'm your host, John Stadtmiller. And John in Canada. I guess Gary in Florida went bye-byes.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Hi, John.
Hey. Yeah, to defeat these evildoers is actually really easy. And I think your last caller put it all together quite well in one of his statements where he's suggesting that our most pressing need right now is to have a media that free flows our ideas with the facts, you know. So let's say we had a Hannity right here and now standing with us soldiers and police officers with cuffs. We go, listen, Bin Laden played no part in 9/11 whatsoever. And he says, yeah, he did. He orchestrated the whole thing. Well, according to Robert Wright, an FBI officer, and many other officers also, he's forbidden to pursue the crime scene leads at the real murder scene. That's the official Bush administration position on all these unresolved crime scene leads, like who put the explosives into the building. If you believe the lie, as Sean Hannity would sell to kill your kids for cash, Bin Laden would have had an accomplice. That to believe Hannity means you can't pursue those leads as who aided in working with Laden to put those explosives to bring the tower down. Because we can't forget, we have video of liquefied iron flowing from the tower like water.
Yeah.
So these are enemies of the soldiers, and they're enemies of police officers. Hannity can't have a free discourse with the facts here because he knows the cops nearest Fox News would put him in cuffs right now and arrest him for treason. These are enemies of the Republic who insist you have a position to support the first-degree murder of Gaddafi. There's no formal charges that have been laid against him.
That's right.
And he is not in violation with the UN, who said Gaddafi call a ceasefire. He did call a ceasefire. They still bomb the country. He's still calling for a ceasefire. Now, he might be guilty of something, but let's get the facts together before we lay claim that it's not warfare to try to kill the leader of a country, overthrow their government, to put in a private banking system where they steal our credit, you know, just like it is in America and Canada and Europe, where people are supposed are painted. We're all just too stupid to understand it's our credit. You know, but that Gaddafi was smart enough to understand that,
yes,
or
he
wanted
was
to fix it, and so was Saddam. He, you know, similarly, the big difference in their banking system with ours is the depositor is the shareholder. There is no magic billionaire or trillionaires walking away with our lives here. So we have to demand justice for this day, otherwise soldiers will continually die, and these soldiers have the minds of 10-year-olds. Go watch the soldiers talking about how they must sell heroin. They're providing security for the shipments of heroin right onto American streets. They confess openly because if they don't do it, the Taliban will.
Mm-hmm.
And the Taliban, you know, they're fundamentalists. They made it illegal against Allah's interest to sell heroin on American streets to, you know, to cause your kids to become addicts so severe that they have to rape, rob, and pillage, too, to make up the cash, because as it is done by Cheney in Burma, they started off the hits of heroin as they are in Canada right now in Vancouver. It costs you like $3 or $5, and you can be stoned for 2 days. Oh, wow, that's cheaper than beer. And you ask a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, he's going to think, well, maybe I will try it a little bit. Give it a little whatever.
Well,
he gives it a little try,
yeah.
He's hooked for life, and you become so addicted, your body goes into convulsions until you get another hit. And you know what they do? They jack that price up, boy. $50 a hit after that. They know you're going to have to rob your grandmother.
Well, and John, also, it does something else. Of course, these drugs are illegal. They're bad. They're destructive, even though the government is in there protecting the heroin fields in Afghanistan. And, of course, we have all these major felony laws on the books for distribution and use and all that. And it's just another tool. It's the Hegelian dialectic, and this one is one of the most self-destructive ones possible. But yet, they're there to kick in your doors because of this evil drug stuff. And you know what? It might be aiding the Al-Qaeda people. Hang on a second, John. I got a break. We'll be right back.
Are you serious about maintaining or improving your health? If you are, you need Terravim. Terravim offers a full line of vitamins, minerals, and herbs for people serious about enjoying a healthy lifestyle. Our product lines include Alamax, Magnesen, Silver 100, Natura Health Products, Gala Herbs, and Terravim's private label, and undergo rigorous clinical studies by leading researchers and contain physician-grade research-based therapeutic doses of nutrients. All of our vitamin, mineral, and herb products are manufactured under current good manufacturing practices. This is in an FDA-registered production facility, and we guarantee that the ingredients in the supplements are exactly what's on the label. We also provide free consultation for all our products along with general wellness information. All orders over $45 ship free, and all orders received by 3 p.m. ship the same day. When shopping online, enter the coupon code RBN for a 10% discount. To order now, call 1-866-647-4372. That's 1-866-647-4372 or visit terravim.com.
Attention RBN listeners, the Freeze-Dry Guy, providing the finest in long-term storage food since 1970. Today, the U.S. military and the U.S. submarine service enjoy using these products extensively. In actual scientific tests, these foods typically maintain their high nutritional value in excess of 30 years. These foods are delicious tasting, hearty, light to carry, and easy to prepare under the most adverse conditions. Unfortunately, many people building a family food storage program, as well as many companies providing emergency feeding programs, simply do not give you enough protein, especially animal protein. No other food satisfies like animal protein during stressful times. If you're a meat eater, you will definitely want our freeze-dried meats and entrees. But we do offer vegetarian items as well. Visit freezedryguide.com or call 866-404-FOOD, 866-404-3663. Freeze Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Help, I've fallen and I can't get up. If you have an elderly loved one, please listen. Whether it's fire danger, a serious fall, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company with the slogan, Help, I've Fallen and I Can't Get Up, protects 60,000 members.
The first time I fell in that bedroom and I couldn't reach the phone.
When you have a heart attack like I did and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Listen to former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. C. Everett Koop.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone. That's why I wear one.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can often postpone going to a nursing home for several years. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now 1-800-410-0739. 1-800-410-0739. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure, 1-800-410-0739.
Get ready for Real Talk Radio. You're listening to the National Intel Report with your host, John Stadtmiller.
John, I want to ask you, what was the reaction of the press up there with Obama's speech about the big troop drawdown?
Well, you know, Canada, I think we might have talked maybe a while ago. The situation here in Canada is just totally different. We're living in a foreign reality. It's a different kind of thing. Like, we have one national news station, CBC. We have one national radio broadcaster, essentially called Chorus Radio Network, and they just viciously, criminally assault our entire nation on a daily basis. They steal all the money from the lotteries. They advocate killing all the innocent people in Afghanistan to escape Bush and Cheney for closing investigations. The crime is called obstruction. Torture, of course, warrants death, but they'll just keep promoting these teenage minds in Quebec to sacrifice their lives further for their criminal gain, because they know if the truth prevails, a lot of those guys are going to prison also. So,
yeah.
No, they'll just encourage us to take the fluoride, drink your poison, and not tell us about the DEA. You know, the DEA gave out a video, and I think that I look at this video as a plea for to America for help. The DEA is in Afghanistan. They're surrounded by soldiers who can be recruited from third world military dictatorships wearing American uniforms, can be recruited from LA street gangs with what they call moral waivers. So they're surrounded by soldiers with AK-47s or whatever hardware they have, and the DEA is sitting at a table talking to the American military heads on what fields not to touch. You know, and they gave out this video, and it was shown on CNN, you know, and everybody is being robbed by this serious weapon of warfare heroin is. You know, it's such a sad thing that people don't understand that this can tear us down just as quick as, well, maybe not as just as quick, but pretty quick. You know, a bunch of kids get addicted to heroin, like they've done in so many other countries. Like in Burma, everybody becomes addicted, so you have to work at essentially a slave labor camp just to make money to get your next hit, and people will do that right to their last breath because they're neurological.
Funny, I remember railroads being built in this country by Chinese, and there wasn't any of those camps that didn't have what? An opium den.
Yeah, but yeah. They'll make sure it's freely available in the prison system, too.
Look, if you want drugs in prison, the variety is more available to the prisoners in prisons than really on the streets.
Oh, I bet it's true. There's no accountability.
Anywhere. Oh, John, it's sanctioned. I mean, because those drugs are going to come in. They're controlled. They know what's coming in. They know who's taking them. Hell, they even know who's being paid off. And it's the guys on the other side of the bars that should be in there with the guys on the other side of the bars. Hey, John,
thanks
for your call. I appreciate it, my friend.
Okay. All right. We'll try to answer this tomorrow then. But again, talk to you later. Bye.
Okay. Oh, the heck with it. I'm going to go for it. And again, this is coming out of the Institute of Pacific Relations, which with the State Department was instrumental in flipping China to make sure it went commie. Clearly, this was calling for intervention. Clearly, it was implying that the Chinese communists were not really communists. It went on to say, the president has asked General Marshall, now this is testimony given in front of the subcommittee here, a resolution relating to the internal security of the United States. Testimony given almost for a full year in front of this internal security subcommittee from July 25, 51 to June 20th of 1952. The president has asked General Marshall to go to China for the purpose of bringing to bear the influence of the United States. Specifically, General Marshall will endeavor to influence the Chinese government to call a national conference of representatives of a major political elements to bring about the unification of China. And concurrently, effect a cessation of hostilities, particularly in North China. Now, General Marshall was being sent as a special representative of the president for bringing to bear upon the government of a sovereign country the influence of the United States towards achieving in that country's objectives, which the president and the secretary of state of the United States had decided were desirable. The last paragraph of the memorandum of December 9th conveyed a request by the Department of State that the War Department arranged for directions to General Wiedemeyer for action to be taken by him. It is noted that the substance of the instruction which the Department of State in the memorandum of December 9 asked the War Department to give General Wiedemeyer was directly contrary to the recommendations which General Wiedemeyer himself had submitted. Mr. Vinson in his testimony recognized this. Thus, the demand for support of the idea of a coalition government. Have you heard that term before? The idea of a coalition government in China, made in May of 1945 by Mao Zedong, taken up by the American Communist Party and recommended to the president by Owen Lattimore in his memorandum July 3, 1945, was adopted and sponsored by Vincent. Memoranda elaborating upon the idea and sponsored and drafted by Vincent and were affirmed by the Secretary of State, these became the basis of the policy in relation to China, which was announced by President Truman on December 15, 1945. And in pursuance to that policy, General Marshall was sent to China to bring to bear upon the Chinese national government the pressure of the United States influence. The subcommittee has obtained from the Department of State copies of a letter addressed by Dean Rusk, Assistant Secretary of State, to Dr. Stanley K. Hornbeck. Let me stop here. What did Kennedy do when Rusk was still around? He canned him. Well, guess what? Mr. Rusk was in some form of authority to help cover up the murder of JFK after his assassination. Ooh, these kind of political enemies? Now, the Stanley K. Hornbeck on May 19, 1950. Respecting an alleged turning point and change in policy regarding China and the reply by Dr. Hornbeck dated June 7th. Dr. Hornbeck served officially in connection with Far Eastern matters during most of the years from 1918 to 1944. He was the Chief of Division of Far Eastern Affairs in the Department of State from 1928 to 1937, was an advisor on the political relations from 1937 to 1944, was an assistant to the Secretary of State in 1944, and was ambassador to the Netherlands from 1944 to 1947. In the course of his reply to Dean Rusk's inquiry, Dr. Hornbeck wrote this. He says, "It was then, in the year 1945, and not before then, that the government of the United States first, having taken action inconsistent with the tradition and commitment in regard to China, embarked upon what became a course of intervention in regard to the civil conflict, the conflict between the national government and the communist in China. It was then that words and actions of the government of the United States began to be expressive as an against and for attitude. Then the thereafter that the government of the United States brought to bear pressures from the national government, pressures were not against the communists, but were on the behalf, pressures not to the disadvantage of the communists, but in effect to the disadvantage of the national government. To the circumstances of the change, to the content and purport of the policy devised in 1945, proclaimed on December 15th of that year, and given expression in word and in deed since then, and to the gross and net consequences thereof, there is no need for attention in the present context. There is, however, in my opinion, great need that the context to the present American involvement as the leading participant in the third global conflict, wherein communist totalitarianism is making war both cold and hot on all states, governments, peoples, institutions, organizations, and persons, disinclined to accept domination by it. There is urgent need that the government in the United States give solicitous attention to that question. Must the United States follow the bitter and discrediting end the downward path in relations to China, on which its feet were set in the fateful year of military victories and diplomatic vagaries in 1945. During the period 1945 to 49, persons associated with the Institute of Pacific Relations were instrumental in keeping United States policy on course favorable to communist objectives in China. The IPR against aid to Chiang Kai-shek they're getting ready to talk about here. Basically, the American Communist Party program for China for the period beginning with the Japanese surrender called for, one, the discouragement of the United States' assistance to Chinese national government, and B, encouragement of the United States' assistance to Chinese communists. Dr. Max Juergen, who in 1945 had been present at the first of the two founding meetings of the Committee for a Democratic Far Eastern Policy, an organization set up by the communists to influence American public opinion on China, stated that the leader at these meetings was Frederick V. Field, who held high positions in the Institute for Pacific Relations until that very year and was then a member of its executive committee. Field had been instructed by Eugene Dennis, chairman of the American Communist Party, to set up this organization and to promulgate this policy. Maxwell Stewart, his wife, Marguerite S. Stewart, and Mrs. Edgar Snow, all of the IPR, were also present at one or both of these meetings. This is history. It is undisputed. It is fact. And it's here for your perusal. We'll continue this on the other side, right out of the State Department.
estrogen dominance, a brand new 20th century disease, a phrase coined by Dr. John R. Lee 35 years ago. Dr. Lee proved that all the estrogen that is coming from food and water is having a devastating effect on our health. The rapid rise in breast cancer, uterine cancer, prostate cancer, weight gain, osteoporosis, feminizing of our boys and early puberty of our girls, and also the destruction of natural killer cell function. Natural killer cells are our only protection from cancer and viral infection. Dr. Lee found that using natural progesterone, about 20 milligrams per day, would not only reverse osteoporosis, but would greatly reduce the cancer issues, as well as dozens of other health challenges we face today. Visit our website, healthlinkamerica.com, to order the DVD on hormone imbalance. Learn how hormone imbalance destroys the immune system and get started on natural progesterone and Cyto-S. It will not only change your life, it may in fact save your life. Once again, that website is healthlinkamerica.com.
Are skyrocketing prescription costs draining your budget? If you don't have insurance or are taking medication not covered by insurance, the Powerhouse Savings Card can lower your prescription costs by up to 50%. Now you and your family can save 20 to 50% on all prescriptions. It's accepted by most pharmacies and mail-order pharmacies nationwide. No prescription card is easier to use. Just show your card and save 20 to 50% right on the spot. There are no monthly fees. Just a one-time processing fee of only $4.95 for you and your immediate family. Stop paying full price for prescriptions. Stop going without the medication you need because it costs too much. Now your family can get the prescriptions they need at a cost you can afford. Call 1-800-963-0232 now and start saving money with the Powerhouse Savings Card. Call 1-800-963-0232. 1-800-963-0232. 1-800-963-0232. 0232.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com. Where reality shatters illusion.
Almost simultaneously, another group of IPR persons, including Frederick V. Field, T.A. Bison, Israel Epstein, Mrs. Edward C. Carter, Lawrence E. Salisbury, Mrs. Edgar Snow, and Ilona Rolfe Sewells, together with a group of others, signed a letter to President Truman, which appeared in the Daily Worker of October 17, 1945. The letter urged the president to avert civil war in China by not turning over equipment to Chiang, and I'm sure this is Chiang Kai-shek, and deplored the use of American planes and other military equipment which had been made available to the Chinese nationalists by General Wiedemeyer and Ambassador Hurley. There are other instances of this broad trend, but only these few are cited to give political backdrop to the historical events being shaped by the Marshall Mission, which, as we showed in the preceding section, was set in motion at least to some extent by Owen Lattimore and John Carter Vincent, both active and trusted members of the Institute for Pacific Relations. This will relate how IPR people in and out of government were instrumental in keeping the United States policy on course that was anti-Chiang and often pro-communist in orientation. Well, General Marshall intervenes in China. At the end of 1945, when General Marshall left for China, the balance of power was with the Chinese nationalist and remained so at least until June 1946. Chiang's divisions were chasing the communists northward, and the prospect of victory by nationalist China was at its highest. And this was given by testimony before the subcommittee on May 29th of 1952. However, when General Marshall arrived in China, he undertook to bring about the coalition government, which his directive demanded. And he commenced to bring pressure on Chiang in order to, in order to force his compliance. There was a plan in 1946 approved by General Marshall that called for the reduction of the Chinese Nationalist Army to 50 divisions and the incorporation into that army of 10 communist divisions, all of which the incorporation into the army of 10 communist divisions would have been armed by the United States. Now, this plan failed when the coalition failed. Marshall was empowered to grant $500 million loan to the Chinese. This was being withheld pending the establishment of that coalition government. It was, in fact, never granted, but General Wiedemeyer's mission to bring assistance to the Chinese government was conditioned by the terms of General Marshall's directive on the outcome of Marshall's negotiations, the purpose of which was to bring about a coalition government. Sounds fine, doesn't it? They're split up. They got communists over there. They got the nationalist government. Let's make peace. Let's combine them, and then one will absorb the other. But here's the question. Which one was designed to absorb which other? Marshall instituted truce teams, each made up of the Chinese nationalist, one communist, and one American, who undertook to enforce truces between then the winning nationalist and the losing communist. It was testified that the communists, when sore beset, would agree to discuss a truce, and then, instead of coming to terms, would simply regroup, recover their strength, and prepare for new offensives. The parallel between this procedure and the tactics of the communists in Korea today was called to the attention of the subcommittee. And by the way, I have a whole other document here that I do not have time to get into, but Lieutenant Colonel Bud Farrell, United States Air Force, retired, that was in fact in the Korean conflict. He admitted that he was getting orders, he didn't know it at the time, but from communist, Russian communist generals. American assistance to the Chinese government stopped in 1946. When the Chinese government did not affect this coalition, by the summer of 1946, United States military assistance to China was brought to an end. Not only did the United States stop sending military supplies to the Chinese government, the shipment of war materials actually purchased by the Chinese also was halted. The Chinese also had purchased surplus equipment that remained on Okinawa and other Pacific islands. Even the shipment of this was banned, according to the General Chenault's testimony in May 29th of 1952. A complete embargo took effect in the summer of 1946. It was maintained at least until May of 47. General Chenault testified that the first shipment arrived in Shanghai in December of 1948. Chenault further stated that the war materials sent to China after the embargo did not arrive in time to aid the Chinese nationalists in the field. Admiral Cook was commanded by the United States 7th Fleet in Chinese waters, 1945-1946, testified that the Chinese had a number of divisions equipped with American arms. When the flow of American ammunition was stopped, these divisions lost their firepower and were defeated. Even after the 18th Congress appropriated $125 million for aid to the Chinese, shipments were delayed, and when the guns finally reached the Chinese general in North China, they were without bolts and therefore useless. We'll be back right after this short break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Do you need help getting your child to behave? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'm willing to give away thousands of my best-selling total transformation programs for free. All you do is tell us how the program works for you and your family. Did it turn around your child's behavior? Did the screaming and arguing stop in your home? Is he doing better in school? The total transformation has helped hundreds of thousands of families. I want to see what it can do for you, and I'm willing to let you have it for free. Just order my program. Use it with your child, then send me your feedback. I'll refund the purchase price of the program. You keep the Total Transformation Program forever, for free. You don't have to struggle with your child's bad behavior one more day, because now you can try my Total Transformation, and the program will be free.
Limited number of free programs available. Call now. 1-800-583-1093. 1-800-583-1093. That's 1-800-583-1093.
Introducing the new Go Berkey Kit, the first of its kind portable water purification system for those on the go. The new Go Berkey system has an amazing output of about a gallon an hour. Each Go Berkey Kit includes a 1-quart high-quality stainless steel system, complete with a black Berkey purification element, a generic sports bottle, and a nylon carrying case. The whole kit weighs a mere 2.25 pounds. With an expected element life of around 3,000 gallons, you can refill the Go Berkey system up to an incredible 12,000 times before needing to replace the element. The new Go Berkey kit is perfect for backpacking, hiking, emergency packs, bug out bags, international travel, car emergency kits, or for your desk at home or at work. Get your Go Berkey kit today for only $139 by calling 800-724-2719. That's 800-724-2719. Go to republicbroadcasting.org. The online store, it's a featured product.
Do you know the truth about cancer treatments? Do you realize that with all presently accepted methods, you are not correctly attacking the cancer and you are mostly fighting to survive the treatment? Do you realize that mutilating surgery, burning and poisoning of your entire system are totally unnecessary? But now it's cancer's turn to die with LaserMed Incorporated's patented methodology. Without cutting, bleeding, drugs, or damaging radiation, we can destroy skin cancer and breast tumors of any size without adverse side effects at our physician's office. Laser technology at its best. For more information, visit www.lasemedinc.com on the web. That's www.lasemedinc.com.
Call now, 501-255-0528. 501-255-0528. 501-255-0528.
You're tuned in to the National Intel Report, the real talk radio show.
You starting to get the implications of this? An official compilation prepared by the Department of Defense showed that from June 30, 1946, the approximate time when the embargo went into effect, there was no appreciable assignment of arms to China until the authorization of the 18th Congress for arms aid of $125 million. The report shows that only $17,900,000 in lend-lease aid was supplied between June 30, 1946, and the time the China Aid Act of 1948 became effective, many months after its enactment. In addition, the value of certain ammunition left behind by the Marines, which was picked up by the Chinese, was given as $4,300,000. The Library of Congress Legislative References Services has estimated the cost of the Korean War at $7,931,000,000. Admiral Cook testified that while he was in China in 1946 in charge of the United States Naval Forces, General Marshall said to him during a conversation that the United States had armed the Chinese, but then was disarming them. Now, think about this, folks. We team up with Uncle Joe to go beat the snot out of the Nazis and the Japanese. The Chinese are there with us, beating up on the Japanese. The war ends. And General Patton was right. We had the equipment, the manpower, but not the political will in Washington, D.C. We should have rolled right into Russia and said to Uncle Joe, your gig is up. But instead, that communist regime stayed in place to chop up what was left of Europe, and then we were busily shoring up the new Chinese communist government in China. Smell that? That crap's coming right out of the State Department in the 40s and the 50s. Now, while the process of disarming China was underway, and while the source of ammunition of the Chinese nationalists was drying up, the communists were arming themselves with Japanese arms, which were turned over to them by the conquering Soviet army in Manchuria. The United States policy discourages aid to Chiang. Professor William McGovern went to China in 1947 as a consultant to the Congressional Committee on Foreign Affairs. In China, he was briefed by Raymond Ludden, who was the ranking United States Foreign Service officer in China. He stated that the briefing was favorable to the communists and presented a dim picture of nationalist prospects. Professor McGovern further testified that while in China, he was told by General Lucas, head of the United States Army mission in China, that the Army mission was not allowed to give any effective aid or tactical assistance to the Chinese in their fight against the communists. McGovern quoted General Lucas as saying he acted not from personal choice, but by directive of the Defense Department. When the Marines were being reduced in force in 1947, Admiral Cook sought to have their obsolescent equipment dumped so as to allow the Chinese nationalists to obtain it. He testified that John Carter Vincent, then head of the Far Eastern Division of the State Department, opposed this, but that General Marshall overruled Vincent. The testimony was contradicted by Vincent, of course. John Carter Vincent acknowledged having drafted in the fall of 1946 a memorandum that became the presidential message to Chiang Kai-shek, transmitted on August 10, 1946, wherein Chiang Kai-shek was charged with using force against Chinese liberals. This is a matter of congressional record, folks. I'm not making this stuff up. And with failure to understand the liberal trend of the times, the letter threatened that unless the Chinese came to terms with the communists, it would become necessary to redefine and explain the position of the United States to the people of America. Chiang's reply was to the effect that the Chinese were making every effort to come to terms with the communists, but that the latter kept breaking the truce to suit their own purposes. During the 1946-47 period, John Carter Vincent was head of the Far Eastern Office of the State Department, and as such was regarded as an official spokesman on the United States foreign policy. On November 12, 1946, speaking before the National Foreign Trade Council, and knowing that he would be understood as speaking of China, Mr. Vincent said this: "What is unsound for private capital is unsound for government capital. It is unsound to invest private or public capital in countries where there is widespread corruption in business, in official circles, where a government is wasting its substance on excessive armament where the threat or fact of civil war exists, where tendencies toward government monopolization exclude American business, or where democratic concepts of governments are controlling." Wait a minute. So he's saying here that this is not necessarily representing the wishes of the American government by way of commerce because, you know, we don't feel that they're that friendly to us. Really? Let's fast forward to today. The communists weren't happy with receiving American companies over there to use their labor to produce Chinese goods. And many of the corporately owned Chinese government businesses working very hard to ship their goods over to America for sale on our shelves at places like Wally World by way of most favored nation status. For what? Remember how they tried to sell this to us, folks? That if we give them a taste of capitalism, that the people of China will flip that government. No, in fact, is what the United States has been doing, is aiding and abetting communists ever since communism came into being. These facts are unrefuted, and they are part of the American history. And we complain about foreign policy today. My God. And how many people from our ranks died fighting these supposed communists in Korea, in Vietnam, other places around the globe? Mr. Vincent's testimony respecting this statement, its validity and its motivation, is extremely interesting. On January 21st, 1947, Mr. Vincent made a speech at Cornell University, which was reported in the press, in part as follows. John Carter Vincent declared tonight that the United States should avoid relying on the preservation of the status quo in China and other areas, that for the United States to throw its weight on the side of the status quo was short-sighted because it would fail to encourage progressive elements. What the hell did that just say? I'm a communist. I am a communist. Remember that progressive term that's being used today in this country. The progressives, the liberals. When asked in the 60s of our little UN shoe banger, Mr. Khrushchev, about the liberals that were operating inside this country, he said, a reporter had asked him, what about the communists, sir, inside this country, meaning the United States? He's pursed his lips, held up his index finger, and he was chiding the reporter. And he says, here, we don't call them communists. We call them liberals. Now, I don't know what the hell happened to people's minds. Did they take a little bit more, too much LSD? Did they have too much sex during the 60s? Because then the revolution started in this country to turn the young against the old. There was a revolution in this country taking place, and today you can tune in and watch any flipping communist that you want. Rachel Maddow, she's very good at her job. Democracy Now. Any number of shows. And then, of course, you're only being spoon-fed the antithesis of that. Neocons, the new conservatives. But they're nothing more than nation builders and destroyers themselves. And support what? The military-industrial complex that's trying to pop the Middle East inside out right now. I'll continue with this. This is important stuff, folks. I've wanted to do this for weeks. I want it on record. Though the news reports of his speech mentioned China, Mr. Vincent contended before the subcommittee that his reference was to Asia in general rather than to China in particular. Other IPR leaders against Chang. During the period, Mr. Philip C. Jessup expressed to Admiral Cook opposition to the United States' aid for the nationalist government. General Chenault testified that he urged Jessup not to release the white paper as it would undermine the nationalist government. The white paper was nevertheless released. Jessup acknowledged before the Foreign Relations Committee that he edited the white paper, which was released in July 30th of 1949. Nomination hearings before the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee. A letter written by Edward C. Carter to Little, Brown, and Company in connection with the Israel Epstein's book, The Unfinished Revolution in China, shows how Carter sought to use the book to influence the leaders of the State Department and Congress. Carter and Epstein were associated in the IPR. Carter was questioned at length about this letter, as was John K. Fairbanks, a letter written June 12, 1947. As follows. Dear Miss Ford, this is to acknowledge Epstein's The Unfinished Revolution in China, which you so kindly sent me a few days ago. I've already read two-thirds of it and hope to complete it within a few days. I think of it as almost utmost importance that you devise some means of getting it read at an early date, among others by Secretary of State George Marshall, Senators Vandenberg, Morris, and Ives, John Foster Dulles, John Carter Vinson, and the State Department. You will know better than I how to make certain that they read it in the near future. A letter from me on this subject might lead a few of them to think that I was recommending it because I was an admirer of Epstein's, and that reason they might slightly discount my recommendations. I have another suggestion to make. The book is so full of profound understanding and admiration of the Chinese people that I think it equally important to find ways and means of getting a wide circulation in China. Have you thought of the Chinese edition? Question mark. In the past, there's been a tendency for Shanghai publishers to get out pirated editions in English. This would be all to the good if the printing was done accurately and in full text was reprinted. Sometimes, for mercenary reasons, they make substantial cuts. Would it be out of the question for you to consider, at an early date, printing a cheap paperback cover for maximum circulation in India, the Philippines, and China, with the expectation that some orders would come in from Indochina, Siam, Burma, and the Netherlands, East Indies? The book combines in one volume several books, its penetrating history of China during the war years. It is a sociological document of importance, and its military handbook that might have been enormous value to the Marquis in France and even to the little handful of anti-Hitler Germans in Germany. It might become a military and political handbook for Vietnam and in other Asiatic areas if the imperialist powers try to reassert their pre-Pearl Harbor domination. The book is not so much needed in the communist areas in China as it is in the, and excuse me if I butcher this, the Kuomintang areas, where its authoritative counts would give new hope, as well as new methods to the millions of Chinese who are dissatisfied with the right-wing Kuomintang domination. You have only to read the newspapers to discover what a large political market for Epstein's book there is amongst non-communist professors and students of the Chinese universities. The history of this last few decades proves conclusively, that the Chinese student movements are far more influential in China than in many other countries in starting new and creative political and social movements. More than at any other time in recent years, there is a large British public, both in the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia and New Zealand, which would find the book illuminating, not only with reference to China, but in their thinking with references to a great many movements in the continent of Europe and elsewhere. I congratulate Little Brown and Country's unerring wisdom in deciding not only to publish the book, but in having no stone unturned in getting a wide circulation. Sincerely yours, Edward C. Carter. P.S. I have not consulted Epstein with reference to this letter. I hope, however, that it may meet with his approval and elicit further concrete suggestions from him. I assume that John Carter Vincent would read the book with very open mind. Probably he is generally acquainted with most of the material, but he's probably never seen it as organized and as logical. If he were sold on a book, he might persuade General Marshall to read it from cover to cover. Of course, many will say that Epstein is a special pleader. I think this is probably true, but I think he's pleading for more sound analysis of the world and than many of the other current special pleaders. I hear that the New York Times has asked Owen Lattimore to review the book. I hope other publications will make as wise a choice. I imagine the Kuomintang government will put the book on its forbidden list for import to China. I would hope that you would get it into the hands of the Ambassador Leighton Stewart and some of the American correspondents like Benjamin Wells, Christopher Wran, and Arch Steele, Sung Fo, Madeline Sun, Yat-sen, and a few others. Well, both Owen and Eleanor Lattimore were also active during this period. Eleanor Lattimore was a staff worker for a period that ran the Washington office of the IPR in a pamphlet entitled China Yesterday and Today, published by the Institute of Pacific Relations in 1946, she wrote this: when we speak of the Chinese communists, we should remember that they stand for something rather different from what is ordinarily meant by the word communist. They are not advocating a Russian system for China, and unlike the Russians, they maintain the rights and private property and enterprise in the areas in their control, because their chief interest at the moment is improving economic conditions of the Chinese farmer and increasing the number of people capable of taking part in political life. They are often described as the peasant party. They have established a system of popular elections in the regions under their control. They favor extending the vote to the people of the rest of the country. And they have long declared that they would support a democratic republic in which not only they themselves, but all other Chinese political parties would be represented. At this time this is being written, negotiations are being carried on between the Chinese government and the communists, which it is hoped would result in a more democratic government. For not until China achieves a government in which the Chinese people are adequately represented, and which brings about agricultural reforms designed to give her farmers enough to live on, while the underlying causes of communism be removed. So you see, communism isn't really communism. And we don't want it after the Russian model, because we all know that sucks pretty bad. So we'll just start calling it different things. We'll give a new meaning to the term communism for the communist Chinese. Now, such representations that the Chinese communists were not real communists was parallel in the memorandum setting forth United States policy for China, signed by the Secretary of State in December of 1945, which referred to the Chinese communist as so-called communist. The record abounds with evidence of the fact that the Chinese Communist Party was at all time a full-fledged member of the Communist International Organization, directed from Moscow. There was testimony that the Chinese communists were trained in Moscow at the rate of between 1,000 and 1,200 per year over a period of many years. This training was supervised by Mao Zedong and leaders of the Chinese Party. The Institute for Pacific Relations was officially aware of this relationship of the Chinese communists to Moscow. One document was found in the IPR files initialed for T.A. Bison, Catherine Porter, Philip Jaffe, W.L. Holland, and the file in which showed the tie between the Communist Chinese Party and the Comintern, as they call it. The Library of Congress received its copy of Owen Lattimore's book, Situation in Asia, in March of 1949. What he wrote, obviously at some time prior to that date, necessarily antedated the utterances and recommendations expressed at the Roundtable Conference, which was held in the fall of 1949, to review the policy for the United States State Department. The suggestions made by Lattimore in the Situation in Asia proceed on the premise that China already had fallen and that the new direction was to be given to policy. His recommendations are directed to a new situation, calling for a new policy in view of the collapse of the nationalist resistance to the communist on the Chinese mainland. Lattimore comments on policy are set forth at some length below, because they will appear again hereafter as expressed by advisors to the United States State Department. And the one last paragraph here. In Situation in Asia, Lattimore wrote that the communist had conquered China, that one of the factors in this conquest was the spirit of revolutionary nationalism, a surge towards independence that the people of the colonial Asia were inevitably experiencing, that the resulting government could not be a communist government, that it would have to be a coalition government, that this coalition, unlike the one sought by General Marshall, when the balance of power was on the non-communist side, would be rather one with the balance of power on the communist side. and that it was imperative for the communists in order to consolidate their power to give at least relative peace, order, and prosperity as a contrast to the long nightmare of war. Therein lies the United States' complicity in the start of communist China. And we wrapped and we gave big wet kisses to Joe Stalin. Because who was he fighting? Oh, he was fighting the Japanese. He was fighting the communists. So we team up with the communists. Because, you know, they had a war, they had an ongoing war with the Nazis. All this was arranged. How did communist Russia come about? And then Russia is tutoring China how to be communist. And for years we were taught, folks, that China and the Russian communists, their ideologies did not mesh. And they were there instructing the new communist leaders. Chiang Kai-shek was out, the new communists were in. So now we're in bed with the communists. Now, through 258 locations in this country, we are going to have the communist Chinese in the millions. Can we look upon the Middle East right now as a major distraction? Is this a run-up to World War III in case they need it? One can offer an opinion. We can't read the future, but I can sure as hell read the past. And we were never there to defeat communism. We were there to aid and abet it, to make it happen, to cause the deaths of millions of people. And this crap came right out of our own government. So where have we come in a half a century? You tell me. Is America going to stand once again? They gave us the boogeyman of the communists. Now we're sleeping with them. Now we got to have a new boogeyman. Oh, that's right. It's the evil Al-Qaeda. You see, this is just a bunch of radical Islamic yahoos that run around just spouting hate for America with their funny little towels on their head and their quaint little practices that aren't democratic. I mean, look what they do to women. Folks, communitarianism. America with a K. I don't care what the hell you call it. The commies have been aided and abetted for many, many years. And we've been told that our soldiers are there to fight communism. We're there to fight for freedom. Well, we're going to be in a fight for freedom, and I'm not so sure we're going to win it. But I'll tell you what, it's going to be one hell of a battle. May God back the right side. But the rest of America has got to find out what this government has done to its own people.
Gold, ever climbing.